Ecclesiastes chapter 1 through chapter 3, the fifth talk in a series titled The Bible's Greatest Hits, was presented by Wes Hurd on October 28, 1997, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
Ecclesiastes. There are 12 chapters in Ecclesiastes, in case you hadn't noticed. And so it's a sizable chunk of text. So there's no way that we can read through the book. And I'm not even going to attempt to go through the chapters quickly, one by one, and kind of overview them. My tack on this is going to be to basically go through the first three chapters of the book of the book of Ecclesiastes, because I think, at least I think at this point, that the intent and the core message of the book can be captured in those three chapters, and that everything that follows from there is more or less anecdotal to the core message of those three chapters. Why this book? Why this topic? This series we're doing is called The Bible's Greatest Hits, and the intent behind it is to try to, in one way or other, exposit biblical texts that we teachers here at the Study Center feel are pretty critical to a grasp of the central message of the gospel in the Bible. So all of these talks, one way or another, I believe, are going to be tied back to the issue of clarifying what the good news is, what the gospel of the Bible is. Normally, when we talk about the human condition, our emphasis in relation to the gospel, our emphasis is on the human moral condition. That is, it's about the corruption of our rebellion and the sin that lies at the core of our hearts. This talk tonight from Ecclesiastes is not about sin per se. My goal tonight is slightly different, to present a picture of the human situation that's intimately related to the issue of human sin. But it's to ask the question, what kind of a world is this that we live in? What should we expect to get from this world? What kind of fulfillment is God going to give his creatures in this world? In this world. In other words, I want to be talking about tonight about a kind of a larger picture or a context for our human experience. Human sin and evil are clearly present, and they form the core, more or less the core of our problem before God. But that is not my focus tonight. It will be on this larger picture, one of kind of the limitations and the boundaries and the conditions which God has set on man and the human condition in his environment. First of all, who is Solomon? Solomon has traditionally been understood as the author of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is a book of Hebrew poetry, so it's an art form, a Hebrew art form. Solomon was the king, the son of King David. And when David was dying, there were people who were rivaling him, who were making claims to the throne that David sat on, but he had promised to Bathsheba that he would give the throne to Solomon, to her son. And so he followed through on that, and he officially passed the crown of Israel from himself to Solomon. Now, early in Solomon's life, the historical account suggests that Solomon is visited by God in a dream, that God communicates with Solomon and basically asks him in this dream what Solomon wants. And Solomon says, "I want wisdom." He basically prays back to God or tells God in this dream that he lacks understanding, he's young, he doesn't know what he's doing, here he is in this responsibility of being king of Israel, and he needs God's help, and he prays that God would grant him to be a wise man, to give him understanding so he could lead the people. A very, very profound and noble request of God. And God sees that and honors that request, and in addition, blesses Solomon's reign as the king of Israel with wealth and power and prestige unrivaled in Israel, unrivaled even in that Middle Eastern area. People came from great distances to see the remarkable kingdom that Solomon built up around him. So that's what this book, who the book is authored by. Ecclesiastes, as I mentioned, is a Hebrew poem, and it contains Solomon's thoughtful observations about real reality. Now, we live at a time, as we mentioned, we were talking earlier about image, and about how image is everything, and how philosophically, as well as even in the popular culture, in the commercial culture that we live in, image is thought of as what is real. What really counts is image, not any kind of substance behind it. I mean, there's really a tension between those things in our culture. And Ecclesiastes, there's a certain sense in which Ecclesiastes is the biblical antidote to that problem. Because Solomon, with his gift of wisdom and understanding, observes the world, observes human behavior, observes the conditions under which man operates and has his being, and he observes and penetrates through the surface, through the image, and gets to the very core and substance of the issues. Ecclesiastes is about a man that's called the preacher, the son of David, the king of Jerusalem, who has all the equipment, all the wealth, all the power, and all the resources to test the reality of the world and all that it offers, and to see what it is made of, how it works, and whether in the end it can be found to fulfill man's deepest desires and needs. Solomon wants to know what is truly substantive and worth human knowing, worth human experiencing, and worth human possessing. What will transcend, Solomon asks, what will transcend the ordinary and be worthy of his energy and full commitment? Interestingly, we can ask, does Solomon ever question meaning, the meaning of reality, or the source of this reality in this world that he's looking at? And the answer to that question is no. Solomon, even though this it presents a dark picture, kind of pessimistic picture of the world, Solomon always, and this time, this reading through this time, clarified even more for me that Solomon is very keenly convinced that anything good in this world has its source in God, and that anything worth having or possessing or doing or believing is from God. So he really never questions those things. From the outset, he believes in the Creator God of his fathers, and he believes in spite of what his quest seeks and finds, that this same God is the good author of all that he experiences and observes about that world, even though in the end, Solomon is clearer about the fact that he thinks that the vast majority of human effort and energy and accomplishment in the end is futile. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity, all is striving after wind. Futility is the theme that Solomon arrives at. So we want to unpack that. Let's take a look right at Ecclesiastes then, if you have a Bible. If you don't, there were some extra Bibles around, and there's a couple up here if you're interested in getting one. I'm going to be reading from the American Standard Bible, so it may be different than yours if you don't have that book, but hang with me. So I'm just going to read through these chapters fairly quickly, and then I'll make some comments about them, and then go on from there. Then we'll go to another couple of places in the Bible that hopefully will add to, will fill out the biblical picture that I think Solomon is accurately portraying of the human situation. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. The word that is translated vanity has its root in the Hebrew word breath. Breath. What it means, what it has to do with, I think, in this poetic use is that it comes out of the idea of a breath. Can you think of anything lighter or more insubstantial than a breath? Has this beginning and quick end. It has no substance. It doesn't continue, just a breath. And there's hardly a picture that we could come up with that would be more apt, in a sense, apparently, to capture what this word means for Solomon. Because he's looking, he's observing, and what he's seeing about the world and about man's operations in the world are that they all end up being like a breath. What advantage does man have in all his work which he does under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Also the sun rises and sun sets and hastens, and hastening to its place it rises there again. Blowing toward the south and then turning toward the north, the wind continues swirling along on its circular courses, the wind returns. All the rivers flow into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers flow, there they flow again. All things are wearisome. Man is not able to tell it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is that which will be. That which has been done is that which will be done. So there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one might say, see this, it is new? Already it has existed for ages, which were before us. There is no remembrance of earlier things, and also of later things which will occur. There will be for them no remembrance among those who will come still later. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. I think this opening, it's kind of a preamble, a poetic preamble to where he's going. He's telling us in very penetrating, artful, poetic terms and language about the ultimate emptiness that he sees in the world. And then he says in verse 13, and I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem, And I set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. It is a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity, all is striving after wind. That word vanity is the same word for futility. It's interesting if you do think about the word vanity or futility here in relation to all is breath, all is a breath, all is striving after breath, wind. What is the wind? It's air moving. And I said to myself, what is crooked cannot be straightened, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said to myself, behold, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. And I set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I realized that this also is striving after wind, because in much wisdom there is much grief, and increasing knowledge results in increasing pain. So, in verses in 1 and 2, the preacher declares his thesis that all human endeavor and experiences is ending in futility from his perspective, from his observation. And then in verses 3 through 11, he elaborates a poetic observation which summarizes some patterns that he sees in nature. He's looking out at nature, at creation. And he sees these patterns in the world, in nature itself. And these patterns are circular, repetitive, cyclical, wearisome in their repetitive nature. And in the end, they make a perfect sort of metaphoric picture of the experience of man. Man, from generation to generation, nothing changes. It's always the same thing with man. The sun rises, the sun sets, and it rises and it sets again. The wind blows south, and then the wind blows north, and then it swirls back again. Rivers flow to the sea, and always flow to the sea, but the sea doesn't fill up. It's just the same. So there's a sense of a picture of repetitive wearisomeness, of trying, of doing over and over again, nothing new, and then the picture of the rivers and the sea. There's this constant flowing, and there's constant filling, but nothing is really filled up. Nothing really changes. It just stays the same. And here I think Solomon is, you know, he's setting a kind of a pessimistic mood here, kind of a dark mood as he observes and ponders these cycles in nature. And why is that? Well, I think what he's doing is that he's looking at the nature of man, and then he's looking out at nature itself, creation itself, and he sees a kind of dull repetitiveness or an analogy between the two. Man does the same things over and over again, and it doesn't seem to go anywhere. It doesn't seem to gain anything new. It doesn't seem to be any gain, and it seems to be vain, in the sense that it doesn't make any, nothing is profited, nothing is gained. And the same thing with, he looks at nature and he just sees these patterns, and he's only calling attention to the patterns, really. He's not saying that nature is ugly or nature is not beautiful or awesome or anything. He's just looking at the patterns, and he's saying, he's using them to draw an analogy here. Solomon observes that this is the same, that these cycles and repetitiveness is the same with the heart of man, that there's a sense in which the heart of man is never filled up with living and life, that it never becomes full. It's always unsatisfied. Humans see, he says, but they're not satisfied with seeing. They see and they see and they see and they see more, but they're never fulfilled or satisfied with their seeing. And their ears are filled, but they're never satisfied and fulfilled with what they hear. And all these observations lead him to the question, is there anything new that happens on the earth? And his answer is no. What is the significance of the question? Well, it occurs to me that the significance might be that if Solomon, in his observing and looking, saw anything, any clue, any glimmer that, there's something new. I haven't seen that before. I've never heard of that before. If he saw something new, that maybe there would be some reason for him to conclude that that there's something hopeful, that things aren't always going to be the same. It would give him some glimmer of hope for the yearning of a fulfillment that he doesn't seem to be able to catch the drift of at this point. And it will be some, perhaps this this something new, if he saw it, would give him hope that human life itself will actually not be this wearisome, repetitive, cyclical, endlessly futile kind of experience. Then in verses 13 through 18 of chapter 1 here, he declares that he is going to do something. He says, I am going to set my mind to seek and to explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. He says, and it's translated here, it is a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. I like the translation that I found in another place where it said, basically, the word task is not there. Grievous task is translated in another place, that this thing that man has to do is a sore trouble. And what is it that he has to do? He says, it is a grievous thing, or it is a sore trouble which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. And what is that thing? Well, it is that he is put in this world and given the task to live out and experience human existence and to try to sort out from that what this is all about. What this world and what his human existence is all about. And he says this is a grievous, sore, troubling task that he has to carry out. So the preacher sets this task before himself and he says, I am going to use my wisdom. I am going to wisely observe and assess all the phenomena of human experience that are available to me. He previews his conclusion in the last part of the chapter there, those last verses. He previews what his conclusion will be, that everything he tries to experience, everything he tries to calculate, everything he tries to build, everything he tries to think, everything he tries to accomplish and to do, ends up in this category of being futile in the end. And this haunts Solomon. It's interesting in that last verse, he says, because in much wisdom there is much grief, and increasing knowledge results in increasing pain. It occurs to me that for Solomon is a really profound and penetrating truth, in that here was a man who was gifted by God with great wisdom, knowledge, and knowledge-gaining apparatus. That is, he was a brilliant man. He was given great analytic skills and observing skills and insight. And for Solomon, he says, where all that has taken me, all that wisdom, what has it got me? What has all that knowledge got me? More pain. Why? Because I think at this point, even at this point, we conclude it's probably because what he's been observing, what he's been finding out, has led him to conclude that this world doesn't offer what he wants. This world does not offer to him anything that would be really satisfying and fulfilling in this world. So chapter 2. He says, I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure. And I think, what is the you there? I think he's going to test life. I will test you, life, with pleasure. So enjoy yourself, and behold, it too was futility. I said of laughter, it is madness, and of pleasure, what does it accomplish? I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine, while my mind was guiding me wisely, and how to take hold of folly until I could see what good there is for the sons of men to do under heaven the few years of their lives. I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself. I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made ponds of water for myself, from which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves, and I had home-born slaves, and I possessed flocks and herds larger than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. Also I collected for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I provided for myself male and female singers and the pleasures of men, many concubines. And then I became great and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also stood by me. So all the way through his doing here, whether it's physical pleasure, hedonistic pleasure, whatever it is, he's claiming that he's keeping his wisdom as best he can. He's keeping his wisdom intact because he wants to use that wisdom to assess the experience of what he's doing, to draw objective conclusions about what he's doing and what he's finding out. And all that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor. Thus I considered all my activities, which my hands had done, and the labors which I had exerted, and behold, all was vanity, all was futility, all was striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun. So I turned to consider wisdom, madness, folly. What will the man do who will come after the king except what has already been done? And I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I know that one fate befalls them both. And then I said to myself, as the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. Why then have I become extremely wise? So I said to myself, this too is futility. This too is vanity. For there is no lasting remembrance of the wise man, as there is no remembrance of the fool. Inasmuch as in the coming days all will be forgotten, and how the wise man and the fool alike die. So I hated life, for the work which had been done under the sun was grievous to me, because everything is futility and striving after wind. And thus I hated all the fruit of my labor which I had labored under the sun, for I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool? Yet he will have control over all the fruit of my labor, for which I have labored by acting wisely under the sun. This too is vanity. Therefore I completely despaired of all the fruit of my labor for which I labored under the sun. When there is a man who has labored with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and then he gives his legacy to one who has not labored with them, this too is vanity and a great evil. For what does a man get in all his labor and in his striving with which he labors under the sun? Because all his days his task is painful and grievous. Even at night his mind does not rest. This too is vanity. There is nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen, that it is from the hand of God. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him, that is, without God? For to a person who is good in his sight, he has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, while to the sinner he has given the task of gathering and collecting, so that he may give to one who is good in God's sight. This too is vanity and striving after wind. Now, really don't have time to, nor do I have an understanding of all the things that are going on in this chapter. But I want to point out a few things. First of all, Solomon says, Come now, I will test you, life, with pleasure. And I'm going to allude to something earlier. In the last chapter, in verse 13, which ties in with this, he says, I set with my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. This is the task that he's going to undertake. It's interesting, those two words. He says, I'm going to seek and to explore. It's interesting because those two words capture the two ways that you would do research. One way to do research is depth research. You study an acorn, and you study everything there is about an acorn, and you go into depth down to the microscopic level and just everything about an acorn. That's depth research on one thing, on a subject. There's another kind of research which surveys things. It looks at maybe all kinds of acorns or all kinds of the places where acorns are found. It surveys all the territory, all the literature, all the phenomena regarding this thing. And Solomon, the two words that are used here in this text, this is what is suggested he's going to do. He's going to go about this task of testing the world, observing the world, and coming to conclusions, and he is going to do it in depth and expansively. He is going to cover everything. He is going to really look broadly at the subject as well as in depth. So in chapter 2 then, he basically catalogs for us what it is he set about to observe. What he was going to do, what he was going to explore, what he was going to experience. And what does he say? He says he's going to explore pleasure and laughter, and he's going to explore hedonistic bodily stimulation, the stimulation of his body for pleasure. He's going to explore folly. He's going to build things. He's going to explore the artful building of grand buildings that will flatter him. He's going to plant vineyards and gardens and parks and trees, and he's going to possess human beings as slaves and animal workers, and he's going to have wealth and power that comes with it, and he's going to explore sexual pleasure. Virtually all that he could think of to pursue and that it seemed like it might yield something to him, he goes for it. He's going to see if any of these things, if grasped and used and wrung out, if they can yield to him the experience of fulfillment that he's looking for. And then he turns to the very tool that he's using. He turns to wisdom and he says, now what about this gift that I have that I'm using? I'm using wisdom to explore all these things. And he says, that's futile too. Why? In the end, everything that his wisdom has gained him is either going to be passed on to someone, is going to probably be passed on to someone, and who knows whether that person will do anything worthwhile with it, or will it do that person any good to get it? Those are open, unanswerable questions for Solomon. And he suggests that since he can't control that, that all this gain that he's made, ultimately, in an ongoing sense, beyond his own generation, but beyond that, in a lasting sense, even that appears to him to be futile because he doesn't have any control on it. He can't guarantee that all of his work is going to end up being worth something to somebody else or actually beneficial to somebody else. And this is because, I mean, ultimately, it's because of this, the great leveler of death. I mean, ultimately, Solomon, he raises the issue here of how death itself is going to flatten everything out. And he says, the wise man includes himself as a wise man. He says, the wise man and the fool. They're both alike in the end because death gets us both. We both end up dust. So here we see Solomon who's, again, perpetuating, presenting this rather dark and pessimistic mood as he observes these things. And he comes to the conclusion right at the end that it's death itself that ultimately renders human effort in this world to no avail, that it ends up being vain. We could explore that for a while, but it seems to me that that's a very profound, maybe the profound issue for Solomon, that that death itself is the impenetrable and not non-overcomable problem, insurmountable problem, that must play a great bearing on and give great weight to this pessimism that he's living with. Now, chapter 3. We start off in chapter 3 with this very famous, oft-quoted set of stanzas. What was the bird song that it came out in?
Turn, turn, turn.
Turn, turn, turn. Yeah. There is an appointed time for everything, and there is a time for every event under heaven. A time to give birth, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to uproot what is planted, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to tear down, and a time to build up, a time to weep, and a time to laugh, a time to mourn, a time to dance, a time to throw stones, and a time to gather stones, a time to embrace, and a time to shun embracing, a time to search, and a time to give up as lost, a time to keep, and a time to throw away, a time to tear apart and a time to sew again, sew together. A time to be silent and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. What profit is there to the worker from that in which he toils? I have seen the task which God has given the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. He has made everything appropriate in its time. He has also set eternity in their heart, so that no man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end. I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and to do good in one's lifetime. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks and sees good in all his labor, it is a gift of God. I know that everything God does will remain forever. There is nothing to add to it, and there is nothing to take from it. For God has so worked that men shall fear him. That men should fear him. That which has already been, that which has been already, and that which will be, has already been. For God seeks what has passed by. Furthermore, I have seen under the sun that in the place of justice there is wickedness, and in the place of righteousness there is wickedness. And I said to myself, God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man for a time, for every matter, and for every deed is there. And I said to myself concerning the sons of men, God has surely tested them in order for them to see that they are but beasts. For the fate of the sons of men and the fate of beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. Indeed, they all have the same breath, and there is no advantage for man over beast. All is futile. All is vanity. All go to the same place. All came from the dust and shall return to the dust. Who knows that the breath of man shall ascend upward and that the breath of the beast descends downward to the earth? And I have seen that nothing is better than that a man should be happy in his activities, for that is his lot. For who will bring him to see what will occur after him? In this opening series of verses, this is the famous catalog or poetic catalog of human experience, a time for all things and a time for their opposites. This world is genuinely beautiful, and all things fall into a coherent tapestry of events. All things fall into their God-appointed places. And so he's giving us a picture of the fact that, one, he sees these opposites, like a time to kill and a time to heal and weep and a time to laugh and mourn and a time to dance, throw stones and to gather stones, etc. All these, he sees again a kind of repetitiveness, even though there's a variety in human experience, that there's still this repeating, this back and forth. We get a similar kind of feeling in these verses as we do in the early verses of chapter 1, where he talks about the wind blowing and coming back and the rivers flowing and not going anywhere. The same kind of thing. He's talking here about human experience, where there he's talking about nature. He's basically talking about the endeavors of man and his experience. And then he asks the question, what profit is there from the man who works and from his work? And then he comes to this really critical question, which is, key to understanding a very profound fact for understanding what Solomon sees as man's central problem. After he says, what profit is there for the person who works for a meaningful and lasting and fulfilling gain and this task that God has set before human beings to search and to work for a deep fulfillment in this earth? God has set about man all these experiences, a time for this and a time for that, a time for this and its opposite, and it all ends in a kind of circular, unending repetition. And he comes to this profound fact. The problem is that God has given, he has set eternity, as he says in verse 11. He's made everything for its appropriate time. But the problem is that he's made a creature who yearns to be beyond time. He's made a creature who wasn't made for time, ultimately. And he set him in time. In the sense that what ultimately would fulfill man's heart is a kind of existence, the character and quality of existence that would endure and that would last forever. So God has set eternity in the heart of man. We are creatures created to long for things and for experiences which are of such a character and such a substance, if you want to put it that way, that they are intrinsically going to last forever. That's the yearning that lies at the core of us. And another way to look at it is to juxtapose this issue of time, I think, that we are creatures bounded by time and repetition and wearisome, repetitive things, but we yearn for something beyond that, something that is not bounded by time. And what is not bounded by time, obviously God is not bounded by time, and God's character and being is not bounded by time, but his moral character, what is really good, is not bounded by time. Now he goes on in the rest of Ecclesiastes, actually, and this is where we don't have time to deal with this. He goes on and really, he does a lot of observing. He writes a lot of proverbs here, a lot of sayings. And a lot of these sayings, it seems to me, thread together on this issue of good, and what is good is ultimately for Solomon something that is fulfilling and enjoyable. See, and he's looking at the world and he's saying, ultimately there's not much out there after I built all my buildings and I've gained all my wealth and I've had all my pleasures. You know, in the end, my wisdom is telling me, something is telling me that all that stuff ultimately is really not enjoyable in the ultimate sense. Now, and here's something that occurred to me when I was reading this over again. You know, I think if most the vast majority of us, and I certainly would throw myself in this category, if we had the advantages that Solomon had, the wealth, and if you look at the world and you see the privileges and the power and the wealth that God gives to some people, how many of those people with those privileges end up backing away from him and saying, this is nothing? Not very many of them. So this is a truly profound thing that Solomon is doing here. And I think Solomon understands that his gift of insight is a gift from God, that this is something that God has given him. So a couple of conclusions here. God has so set the experience of man on this earth that he is surrounded and immersed in the whirlwinds of activity, of events, of calamities, of beauty and pleasures, and all their possibilities and opposites. And in the midst of all this, there is one profound fact that will not be subverted and will not be overturned, that God has created a creature, man, woman, human beings, bound to the earth, but with a spirit and soul made for eternity, made to be satisfied and filled with things that last forever, for the quality of existence that is worthy of lasting forever. Now, why is this Solomon's experience? I'm just going to kind of put a little stopper in it at this point in Ecclesiastes and refer to a couple of other places in the Bible. I think if we look at the sweep of the biblical teaching on the condition and circumstances of man, we have to go back to Genesis. And when we go back to Genesis 3 and we see the situation, God has given man and woman all they need and has given them at least a provisionally fulfilling atmosphere and environment, and all their needs are met. And they rebel against that. They believe a lie. They believe the devil's lie, and they reject that. They rebel against it. And God has already told them if they do that, they will die. And with that statement, and with that fact, and with that event, death comes and pervades the earthly arena in which man lives. And that death is an alienation from God, and it results in a curse. We don't have time to look at the passage right now, but it results in it. God says he curses the circumstances of man. And I think what we see in Ecclesiastes, if I have this right, I think what we see is some penetrating, wise understanding, albeit dark and pessimistic kinds of observations about the consequences of death being loosed in the world, of death being given reign in the atmosphere of man and in his situation. Death has become an all-pervasive atmosphere and environment, saturating all things. And one of the things about death that gets to the heart of what it is that it is an entropy. It is a spinning out. Instead of gaining and progressing and getting better, there's this things falling apart, things corrupting, things decay. And I think we see the same kind of thing, the sense of repetitiveness and weariness. In the cursing, in the Genesis passage, God tells Adam that he's going to have to work. He's going to gain his food from the ground. He's going to have to work very hard for it. He's going to have to sweat and groan in difficulty to gain it. He's going to get his food, but it's going to grow the very grain that grows from the ground that he will get his food and sustenance from will have thorns intertwined in it. He's going to have to pull the thorns. He's going to have to take the energy and the time and the pain to pull the thorns from the very means by which he gets his food. And I think we see a similar kind of thing. a similar kind of spirit going on here in Solomon's observations, that, and he goes out there and he does all this stuff and he builds all these things and he looks like he's gaining all this ground, only to turn around that he's got to pull the thorns out of it. It falls apart. It isn't working. You know, where there's supposed to be justice, there's wickedness, and where there's supposed to be righteousness, there's wickedness. And where he works with his wisdom, it ends up a fool's going to end up taking it over. A fool is going to inherit all his hard work, all the wisdom, the hard work that wisdom has gained. I mean, this is the same kind of stuff happening that we see in Genesis, prophesied in Genesis. If we go to the New Testament, we can ask this question: doesn't the New Testament present a much more positive picture than Solomon of the human condition? And my quick answer to that is no, it doesn't. Solomon, in his historical circumstances, does not have the full elaborated picture of the revelation of the gospel. The gospel's not clear yet. The promises of God are not all there yet. Solomon has to be seen in a place where the unfolding information that's coming from God is still at a developing stage, and he doesn't have it. Now, I think Solomon was a believer. I think there's reason to understand that, but he definitely is one whose belief is revealed by the humility, ultimately, that we see in the pages of the book. His humility before God and his understanding that in God is the source of all that's good and that all that is worthwhile, and that somehow in the midst of all that, that's his hope. But Solomon still gives us this penetrating analysis and picture that's so rare that if you have eyes to see and ears to hear, as Solomon did, when you look at this world, it is not going to be a rosy picture. It is going to be a mixed bag, and there's going to be great beauty, and there's going to be great decay and sorrow. And ultimately, unless God provides something more than what we've got in Solomon's view in the world, unless God does something more than that, then it's all futility. And if it's all based on man's effort and man's ability to construct something and to manifest something from the world and from his own energies, it's like a breath. Now, in the New Testament, if we just look in a couple of places, in Romans 8, I'm going to go just a few more minutes and then we'll stop for questions and answers. Questions and my lack of answers. In Romans chapter 8, we see Solomon's message in Ecclesiastes echoed. It's here in the New Testament. In at the end of chapter 8, Paul is talking about the struggle of believing in a world where it's easier not to believe, and where righteousness is difficult to pursue. And he talks about the Spirit of God giving us the gift of being able to believe and to continue in that belief and to try to live out that belief. And when he comes to verse 18 of chapter 8, he's talking about the sufferings of this world. He says, "For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed to us." Now that observation of Paul is not one that Solomon makes. Solomon does not say, "Someday there will be great glory." In his historical circumstances and personal circumstances, Solomon can, in fact, be seen to be saying some things that maybe even make you wonder if he believes that there's going to be a positive, glorious afterlife. In fact, he says, you know, who's to say that the end of a beast is any better than the end of a man? We're both going to end up being dust. And who can say? That's kind of a very pessimistic tone. But there's a lot of other weight in Ecclesiastes that would lead me to conclude anyway that Solomon ultimately knew that he needed to trust God for whatever hope he might have of glory, even though he didn't use that word. But in this situation, Paul says, "The anxious longing of creation, verse 19, waits eagerly for the revealing of the sons of God, for the recreation, for the creation was subjected to futility." I think he's talking there about the curse. "Not of its own will, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself also will be set free from its slavery to corruption, into the freedom of glory, the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groans and suffers the pains of childbirth together until now. And not only this, but we also ourselves, having the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, waiting eagerly for the adoption as sons, for our adoption as sons and the redemption of our body." So we do see this picture in the New Testament. There are other places that we could turn to, and perhaps if you want to stay and talk about this for a few minutes, we can do that. Let me just draw some conclusions here. There's just a few remarks, concluding observations. What exactly is the nature of this futility that we're all subjected to? It is like a built-in material and spiritual decay and entropy, it seems to me, in which all efforts to gain a deep, lasting fulfillment from what looks like a promising end, what looks promising, end in a failure to deliver. In that perspective, it is like a loss, in a sense, and Solomon portrays a deep kind of grief over what he sees, on the one hand, as the promise and beauty in this world, but then which he cannot get, even though he goes out and does everything. He tries to squeeze blood from rocks, so to speak, in his effort to gain something fulfilling. But this futility is more like a kind of a dull, abiding, low-grade anguish than an actual loss, because there's a sense in which ultimately no human being in this life ever gets what he or she yearns for and then loses it, and that is what Solomon yearned for. Things of eternal quality and character. We just never get that. We try and we try, and in the end we anguish over the futility of it that sets in. This futility then is kind of like a disease, a sickness, kind of like a rot. Almost invisible at first because of the beauty and possibilities that we see around us. But this futility is ultimately of such a nature that it steals the health of creation from us. What is the health? The health is what is solid and true and eternally good, things that we long to possess and to be. Now, for the believer, we recognize that there's futility in our experience, but our experience with futility has purpose. And I think this is true for Solomon, and I think it was true for this task, that this futility that God is permitting, he's letting pervade the world, has its purpose. That futility, in a sense, is my friend. That futility is my tutor. Why? Because I am a broken creature at my very heart. I am a rebel, and I have corruption and evil that has captured my heart, and it haunts me. And futility is something that also haunts me, and it constantly makes me face into the truth of my human condition and my human situation and my need for a solution outside of this creation. The antidote to futility in this world has been and is being dispensed through the mercy of God and ultimately in the person and work of Jesus. And when we respond by believing the gospel and embracing God's perspective on this life, our faith becomes the means of receiving the antidote to futility, to this futility we're talking about. Our faith in the Bible makes it clear, our faith, the Bible makes clear, is not in vain. In 1 Corinthians 15, there's a passage that talks about Paul's preaching to them in this letter, and he says, your faith is not in vain. Think about that for a minute. He's saying, your faith is not futile. Your faith is the one thing that is not futile. It transcends and overcomes the futility of this world. Why? Because ultimately, believing the promises of God delivers the mercy in which God delivers His promises to be a part of His kingdom, a part of His goodness forever. I just want to make one other remark, and then we'll stop. It occurred to me that in Romans chapter 1, when Paul gets to the end of chapter 1, where he's talking about the wrath of God being revealed from heaven, about against all ungodliness and the unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about them, about God, is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes, His eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. That's what Solomon did. It just occurred to me that the reason that God can hold us under His judgment, and why Paul can say this, in a sense, Solomon gives us testimony to that. Because Solomon did all, he went out into the creation and he tested it and he looked and he observed and he didn't let go until he saw the truth. And it seems to me that that's basically what Paul is saying here. Why the wrath of God will come is because man does not do that. He doesn't do Solomon's task. He doesn't do that. He doesn't wrestle with creation and conclude what Solomon did. Okay, thoughts? Questions? Maybe you saw something in there. Yeah.
Do you think that's the whole reason that he bothers with having us here? I mean, we don't have to be here. I mean, why?
Mm-hmm. So that is the whole reason being that we're going to learn about futility and rise
and
ultimately by the promise of God? Yeah. Could we start with a smaller question?
I thought I'd work here.
Gosh, that's a big question. It does occur to me that God has decided in His wise goodness to make a creation that will be indescribably complex and glorious in its beauty and complexity, that has a purpose and an end. It has a telos. It starts off as an acorn, so to speak, or a seedling, and that grows into this thing that we couldn't, this glorious, huge, amazing picture. And that all, that the futility and the anguish and the suffering and the difficulty of this world, somehow in His plan, in His wise, loving plan, He's decided to let that be a part of the warp and woof, a purposeful part of, in fact, a critical part of what it is that He's doing. But it sure isn't any fun to go through it most of the time. But ultimately, you do sort of, at least for me anyway, you turn around and look at I look at my own ugly failures, humiliating failures. And in the end, if that's what it takes, then I guess that's what it takes.
Isn't it amazing to think that now people think, talking about cloning, you know, mindless bodies so that they can live forever, I suppose. You can just keep your body going forever, but for more futility. Yeah.
Well, when you don't have any other hope, and that very effort and energy, it seems to me, is a reflection of the yearning and the striving and the crying out and the desperation for liberation from death. Liberation, ultimately liberation from what Solomon is crying out about, a futility. I mean, death is the ultimate futility. Don?
Does David talk anywhere about Messiah in any of his
Solomon?
Yes, Solomon. Is there anywhere in any of his writings? Or
I don't know about any of his writings, but certainly not in Ecclesiastes. It was clear from looking at this that he doesn't have a very clear picture at all of the afterlife, certainly a positive view of glory or anything like that.
We've seen the history of Christ, which he didn't get a picture of, but you read through this, and I just see knowing what I know or what I've seen, that if I tried to pull off or went after this kind of a lifestyle just for the sake of proving that it was vanity, it just seems like at some point that's not wise. I mean, you'd have to just say, this is useless. Why am I going to keep exploring all these things? Even if you could somehow set beside yourself and say, but I'm doing it with wisdom intact the whole time. I mean, I'm at some point saying, this guy wastes a lot of time, and he's not very wise.
I think that's what he would say, is that, I mean, it seems to me that ultimately the wisdom that he, at least part of it anyway, that the wisdom that he's laying claim to, and that I think we can admit to him, the wisdom ultimately is that he has this penetrating insight through the surface to the nubs of the real issues, and he the fact that he laments these things is indicative of the fact that his heart, that he's recognizing that his own heart is, and he goes on in other places in here, he talks about God's that there's anything good going on, anything worthwhile at all, if there's anything that we get to experience that it ends up being good, and he talks about things like eating and drinking and being with your family and your friends and with the wife of your youth, and you know, he talks about these really simple things, and he says these are good, and they're good because they're gifts of God. He always links the good to God. So somewhere in the calculus of what's going on with Solomon, he's definitely aware of the fact that God is the source of whatever hope he might have, but it's not really clear in here that he has any kind of a picture of hope that we see in other biblical characters, and I'm not sure what to do with that at this point.
Maybe kind of two questions are related. Along with kind of what Don was pointing out, was just it has kind of occurred to me in the past that when, I mean, there's that story of Solomon asking for wisdom, and then following that is that story where he's put in that position to make a judgment of the two women claiming the child, both of them claiming the child to be their baby, and you know, and he says, well, give me a sword, I'm just going to cut the baby in half and give each of you half. And, you know, the woman that showed the most, you know, sort of worry and grief and all that stuff was the one that he saw was the real mother. And so that's sort of this picture of a certain kind of wisdom. And I can imagine him being young and being very sort of fearful of this task of being king and really wanting to have the kind of wisdom that will help establish him as king and help maintain his kingdom and make it solid and make it a good kingdom, and that his fulfilling the role of king will be a good, you know, fulfillment But there's a sense in which I also kind of feel that when he asked for wisdom, he didn't really know what he was getting into. And that really, in a sense, God sort of gave him wisdom twice, in a sense that he gave him a kind of wisdom that you might call a kind of, maybe a kind of worldly wisdom, a kind of savvy, an insight, maybe a tremendous intellect where he could really kind of be head and shoulders above other people around him and really be, in a sense, worthy of really being in the position that he was. But on the other hand, it seems to me that that he really didn't become truly wise until later in life. And that, in fact, until he had basically lived, I mean, this wisdom that God was giving him essentially gave him, though on the outside to other people, this glorious life, ultimately to him, a really tragic life. I mean, it seems to me that when he's saying all this vanity, and he's, in a sense, he's saying, this is a really tragic situation, in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And interesting, it seems to me that somewhere in the whole mixture of wisdom for him, there is a humility. That's a God-given humility, and that's what it seems to me, in the end, would be his one of the central indicators that he really did ultimately trust God, even though he obviously pursued things that we would call unrighteous or hedonistic or sinful things. But another indication of this humility that he has is, things he says, like in chapter 9, he says, right toward the end of his observations, and he says, "Go then, eat your bread in happiness and drink your wine with a cheerful heart, for God has already approved your works. Let your clothes be white all the time, and let not oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the woman whom you love all the days of your fleeting life, with which he has given you under the sun. For this is your reward in life," and I think he means in this life, "and your toil in which you have labored under the sun." Over and over again, it seems to me, you see these little glimpses in Solomon that he doesn't have this really, he doesn't have a dark picture of God. It's just that he's come to realize that in the end, God has, where elsewhere in Scripture it says that God has hidden great things from the wise and given great things to simple, to children. I mean, there's this sense, and if you get it, if you have eyes to see and ears to hear, that if you work hard and you labor, and you gain from your labor, enjoy it, that's a gift. Genuinely enjoy it, that's a gift. That's a simple thing to enjoy, but a great thing. And in terms of this earth, it's not ultimately get any better than that. And I'm not sure what he means by this. It is good for that you grasp. Wait a minute, that's not it. "Let your clothes be white all the time, and let not oil be lacking from your head." I'm sure that probably has something to do with a Hebrew cultural context there. But he's definitely saying, even though life is futile in an ultimate sense, if God doesn't, I mean, he doesn't say this, but ultimately the implication is if God doesn't fix it, if he doesn't give us more than what we're getting here, this is not ultimately going to satisfy us and fulfill us. But still, there are things in this world that we ought to enjoy. Again, like our friends and simple meals together and the enjoyment of our relationships and our and our relationships with our wives and husbands and our children, all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
It's almost as if he's saying, you know, all of this is really futile, but don't let that stop you from cleaning your clothes and combing your hair. Mm-hmm. I mean, get up in the morning, brush your teeth, and clean your clothes, and act like it's not true. I mean, otherwise you could get nihilistic.
Yeah. Well, I think that's really true, because if you look at the, you know, some people call it the sort of popular culture teenage nihilism that's floating around today. I mean, that nihilism is kind of hip. You know, the dark black, you know, it's kind of the hip thing. You see it, like I said, you see it in all the magazines and popular cultural MTV and all that kind of stuff. But he doesn't really sink into nihilism. He fixes himself on God, ultimately. And even though the observations are not, they're pretty simple and truncated, and they're not as clear and as unpacked as certainly as the New Testament gives us, you still get those hints and clues that he understands life. Ultimately, he would have welcomed Paul's message, the message of Jesus. Yeah.
I guess this is kind of related to what I was bringing up before, but I see Solomon asking for wisdom, and almost like he's asking for wisdom because he feels he needs wisdom to do the things that he needs to do on this earth. And what that ends up leading, but what that request ends up really doing is leading him through a life that, where by the time he gets to the end of his life, he learns wisdom in such a profound way, so much more profound than he had any idea when he was young, that it leads him to such a point where really you kind of imagine that if God were to come to him now and say, okay, Solomon, remember when I asked you that one time in your life, if there's anything in this world that you wanted, now I'm going to ask that same question to you again. Is there anything in this world that you want? And it seems to me that the question that he would ask, the answer that he would give would be, what I want is salvation. You know, wisdom has not been, that wasn't necessarily a bad request, but what it ultimately taught me was that in a sense I asked for the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. When I was given that choice a long time ago, what I should have asked for is, mm-hmm. you know, salvation or maybe even righteousness. Mm-hmm. That wisdom was a good choice, but ultimately that kind of brought me to my knees in the long run. That led me down a path that ultimately led to a lot of heartache and despair and kind of depression, in a sense, a lot of sadness, and that to a point where he realizes that salvation is where his hope really lies ultimately, not in just having wisdom.
And I think that's where the parallel is with us. Seems to me that each one of us in our own we all do this Solomonic thing. If we do come to the truth, if we do come to understand our need for salvation, it is because we have done something like what Solomon did. That if we've tested life, we've tried it, we've done this, we've done that, and ultimately we end up yearning for something, and when the message of the gospel comes along, we say, that's it. That's what we're after.
What's bugging me is this this issue of having eternity set in their hearts. You meet people every day that don't have even a foggy idea that there's anything beyond their immediate life and the pursuit of whatever pleasure or fulfillment or satisfaction they're looking for. And it makes me wonder if that is not something that is one of those things that God in his sovereignty bestows on some people but doesn't on others. You meet people every day that are perfectly happy with their mundane, boring, unsatisfying lives. And then you meet other people who are just walking around in, you know, abject angst all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems to me that maybe it just occurred to me that one thing that might be going on there is what Paul talks about in that Romans 1 passage, where he talks about, as a general rule, man in his foolishness suppresses the truth. That is, there go these critical moments. It seems to me, I know I've hit those critical moments, and some early on, probably still at times, stiff arm. I don't want to deal with that. I don't want to hear that. You know, it's not like it's there, but there's some times that God just pokes, gives those experiences that poke at, do you want to know some more about this, or do you really want to pursue this? And I don't know. And we can actually get to the place where we really don't care, because in our foolishness we've become calloused, such that it takes something unusual, some unusual mercy of God to penetrate.
I'm sorry. What's really frustrating about this book to me is that I confuse pursuit of wisdom for righteousness. Mm-hmm. And I think Tucker helped me see something here, is that if you see that his request for wisdom is righteousness, this book is really out to lunch. Mm-hmm. Because if you can't separate those two, then all you can see is that he's pursuing wisdom, and then you see him leading or going after testing unrighteousness, as if testing unrighteousness is wisdom. And that to me is just, I can't make those things equate. But if he's praying for wisdom, and God's saying, okay, I'm going to teach you something about wisdom, even in your sinfulness, and I'm going to take you through everything there is to see, which is what he said, I think you pointed out, to explore wisdom concerning all that has been done under the heavens. I mean, so he's saying, I'm going to test everything there is to test, right from the onset, and understand something about wisdom. And in the end, his only conclusion is, I think what Tucker said, is that it's just, you know, what God says is right, or pursue godliness, or pursue God, and the things God has given us is good. That's all there's left. I mean, and so he doesn't quite call it righteousness, but pursuing God, doing the things of God, is the only thing there's left.
It seems like the wisdom is definitely a tool or a stage along the way that ultimately... If we think, you know, in broad biblical terms, that wisdom and understanding, true wisdom and true understanding, are what get us to the place where we understand our need, that those are the means by which we come to understand our need, then they work together toward or with ultimately gaining salvation.
You need experience to evaluate what wisdom is. And so he asks for wisdom. God gives him every experience, or God allows him every experience there is to see.
Yeah. Well, actually, at this point, isn't it true that, I mean, he says he already has wisdom at the beginning, and he's going to use it to explore and to seek and to explore and to test.
But you don't get this sense that... You don't really get this sense that righteousness is the real dangling carrot that's out there that he should be pursuing. You don't get that sense.
Yeah.
You get the sense that wisdom is what he's looking yeah. for, and that's what he prayed for.
Well, you know, he's he does say where I, in the place of righteousness there is wickedness, in the place of justice there is wickedness. So it's not like he's not aware at some. I mean, I don't know. It's not like he's not aware of righteousness, but it seems to me that God's purpose in the book, the reason that this book is so powerful and it has such a place in the canon of God's word for us, is that it does address this issue of, does this world or will this world give me what I really yearn for? In a way, it's not really even asking the questions of righteousness.
I think the statement about righteousness is where you would go to expect to see righteousness, there's wickedness. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know that he's saying where you find righteousness, there's wickedness. I mean, I think he's saying that there is no real righteousness,
right.
Or there is no
right.
what I'm looking for, I don't even yeah. see, or where you'd expect to see the best stuff. Ain't there.
That's true. That's part of the fabric of reality. I mean, it seems like he's talking about stuff here that's inescapably the case mm-hmm. about life for every one of us.